have friends, my ex-colleagues still think I'm insane, right? They're like, oh, I do not understand what I'm doing. They do not understand Bitcoin. I'm a developer, right? So I don't shill. I don't sell. You will get Bitcoin in your own time.
Who are the people adopting Bitcoin? What expertise do they possess that enables them to see value in Bitcoin? How is Bitcoin changing their lives? Welcome to Bitcoin with Jake, a podcast that focuses on people's personal journeys to Bitcoin and helps you understand the unique lens of each Bitcoiner. Before we crack on with the episode, humor me with 30 seconds so I can introduce our sponsor of the show. Orange Pill App is solving a problem that I personally felt. I am a user and really believe in the mission. Bitcoin meetups are great, but you can't control exactly who you meet and spend time with, whilst it can be hard to actually get there in the first place. Wouldn't it be much easier if there was a way to connect with Bitcoiners in your local area? Who do you walk past every day that is also experiencing the paradigm shift that is true Bitcoin adoption? Well, this is where the Orange Pill app comes in, dubbed Bitcoin Social Layer. It's an app that allows you to connect with Bitcoiners in an ultra-local sense. For additional information, check out episode number 48 to hear Mateo's journey. He's a great guy, has built and exited businesses before, and has no doubt identified a problem that many people have. Once you've signed up, please do get in touch. Now, on to today's episode. Today, I'm speaking with Rusty Russell. Hey, Rusty, how are you?
Hi, Jake. I'm great.
Thank you so much for joining. This is going to be a conversation that will probably be released after Bitcoin Alive, actually, but is also going to be a way of us getting to know each other a bit better before we are on a panel at this upcoming event in Sydney, which is very exciting. So I look forward to meeting in person. But these conversations all take the same start, at least, which is, what were you up to and where were you when you first came across Bitcoin?
Wow. Okay. So I'm a developer, like a free software developer, and have been for 25 years. So, you know, I always had an interest in other things that are happening in the space, you know, other free software projects and stuff like that. So you get like a scattering of random things. I was a Linux kernel developer at the time. So obviously one of the poster children for like open source free software development. And I'd been paid to do that since 97. So quite a long history of that. But I was always interested in, you know, what else are people doing in space? And so, yeah, these projects come and go and they come across in front of you. You know, I was also fascinated with I was a lurker on the sort of side of the cypherpunk movement and things like that. So, you know, Bitcoin comes along as an interesting open source project trying to do something pretty ambitious. I think, and because in those days, this is sort of 2011, I guess, 2012. It was mentioned a few times before it kind of okay, I'll get off my ass and I'll actually read the white paper and stuff. It was very much a very geeky kind of project to be involved in, doing weird cypherpunk stuff, like it'll never work kind of another fun project, right? So that was kind of my journey, I guess. I started from a technical point of view and viewing it as like a software project, because that's my background. So that's still pretty much my approach. It's a software project, it has interesting properties. And then just 8 years ago, I did a sabbatical from IBM for 6 months because my wife said, you know, that I'm much nicer to live with when I'm working on something I'm passionate about. She's saying, you should do a deep dive in this kind of Bitcoin thing. So I took a sabbatical for 5 months, as it turned out, and hacked around and wrote the pieces of, and not a complete implementation of, a sidechain called Petticoin. The idea was that you'd move your Bitcoin across this sidechain and you basically would have lighter security guarantees to try to solve the scalability problem, right? So what if you wanted to, you know, buy coffee? So it's like, well, you'd move across to Petticoin and you'd buy your coffee there, and then you could, you know, if you accumulate enough that you worry about security again, you move it back to Bitcoin. That was sort of the aim. So I played around with that, did a whole heap of kind of research into how this would work and everything else. Right at the end of that, I got contacted by Greg Maxwell, who was at the time founding Blockstream, and they had written a full paper on how to do sidechains. And I'm like, crap, couldn't you release that 6 months ago? Because that's what I was trying to implement. It would have been really nice just to read your version. Their version was much more ambitious than what I was doing. So naturally, we started talking. Then I came to the end of my sabbatical, and 6 months later, I went across and started working for Blockstream. So I think I was employee number 10 or something, and I've been at Blockstream ever since. So it's been like 7 years. Bit of bait and switch, though, because I was going to be a Bitcoin Core developer, right? You know, work with Bitcoin Core, this will be fun. But between talking to Blockstream and actually joining them, the Lightning white paper dropped, right? And I sat down with the white paper and, you know, read it, and I had to read it three times for it to stick, and I finally figured out what they were talking about. And wrote a series of blog posts, kind of, which was the decoder wheel for like, okay, so this is what they're actually describing in the paper, and here's all the pieces. So a number of people early on got into the Lightning Network through reading my summary of it. And Greg Maxwell said, hey, you know, do you want to go implement the Lightning Network? And I was like, but I thought I was going to get to work with you cool kids. And he was like, go over there and implement that. Because at the time, no one was going to implement it. Taj and Joseph had written this paper, and they were like, well, we've written the paper now, right? We've got day jobs. We've got other stuff to do. But someone's got to implement it, right? Someone's got to try. That was that. And I was the first person to implement a client for the Lightning Network. And that's, you know, rolled into the standards process. And of course, Lightning Labs was founded by Taj and Joseph after that. And so, yeah, we ended up rolling forward with that. 7 years later, here we are, still nose to the grindstone. So that's kind of my journey, really.
Wow, Rusty, I have a ton of questions for you. Okay, well, where should we begin? I think what would be helpful is there's plenty of people out there that are not software developers and don't have deep insights like yourself. So just to keep things very, very simple and high level, and to be blunt as well, I actually didn't necessarily understand the difference between free and open source software and proprietary software until relatively recently, and the importance of the difference between the two. So could you just talk us through how you ended up in this kind of free and open source space just initially? So you mentioned way back in the 90s, you were looking at it. What's different about the characteristics of this type of software and why did you find it interesting?
Yeah, so I was at university in like the early 90s, and there was a bit of an academic bent of people writing software that they were just giving away, right, basically, for free. And there was like a nascent movement, the free software movement, of like people going, no, there's a moral imperative. As software becomes more important in our lives, there's a moral imperative that you should be able to, like science, dissect it, pull it apart, critique it, and everything else. That the idea of copyright that restricts you, we give you the parts, but you can't repair it. Like, you know, it's like buying a car with a bonnet welded shut. That kind of analogy resonated with a few people, but it was very much a pipe dream. It was like, you know, well, yeah, sure. But in the real world, people sell software, and software is produced by giant software companies. And that's how the world works, right? Which is interesting because that's not how the world used to work, but it was definitely how the world worked in the early 90s. And I played with Linux because I was a Unix person. So yeah, Sun, Solaris, and all those kind of brand name things. But, you know, you could get Linux and it was free and it would run on your, you know, you could run on a PC, right? You didn't have to have this big machine to run it. And that was kind of cool at the time, but I still had this thing. It was a toy, right? It wasn't real. And in 1997, I went to the big operating system conference called Usenix in the US. And I decided to run a use Linux track. And all the Linux devs, most of which are like college kids and stuff, showed up and spoke. And I went to several talks at that. But technically, it was an amazing conference. But what changed between me walking in those doors and walking out is that I realized these people were producing serious software, right? This wasn't just they could produce something almost as good as. In many cases, they were beating the huge software houses with proprietary and development, all that stuff that you were supposed to have to develop software. In my head, these randos on the internet were producing something that was compelling. And the second thing is that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work with these guys, right? I want to work with this group of people because these were the best in the world. I'd previously had some experience collaborating on a few different projects over the internet, which, you know, when you're in Adelaide, which is a pretty small pond, it is amazing, right? So I'm a small software dev in a small software house, but I got this exposure to like these world leaders in various fields just by collaborating on software with them, which was just eye-opening at the time. So these two things kind of came to a head and I realized this is what I wanted to do. And so I went home and I went, right, I'm going to hack on some Linux stuff. And next thing you know, I got paid to do it. And this was a big jump too, because I'm like, okay, well, it's one thing to do it as a hobby and go, that's kind of cool. Maybe I can hang out with the cool kids and, you know, when we can produce something really cool. It's another thing to go, well, someone will actually pay me for this. And that was in 98. So I took a contract and I wrote free code and gave it away and they sent me money. And I kept expecting that to end, right? Because it doesn't seem sensible. Well, now it's 2023 and I'm still doing exactly the same thing. I've done that now for over 25 years, right? So there is a philosophy here, which is that basically if something's really, really critical, then you need to give someone all the pieces. Right. If I'm the only one in the world who can repair the software, right? So this normal way you produce software is you basically write it yourself, but then you know the compiler, the machine turns it into something that you can ship. But you can't go the other way. So only the person who's written it has got all the original recipe pieces, can improve it and fix it and everything else. Really, really hard for anyone else to do that work. And that was the way that proprietary software was shipped. But as you can imagine, if something is really, really important to the world, that's a really bad recipe to have someone in control. And when you look at a system like Bitcoin, particularly, obviously that would just never fly. The whole point of Bitcoin is that you can be self-sovereign and you can control it yourself. If that didn't apply to the software that was actually doing the work, it wouldn't even happen, right? But I did go through the social movement. Originally, when I first started working on Linux, it was a toy. It wasn't serious. Like I wasn't a serious programmer. I wasn't doing serious stuff. A number of people were shocked that I kind of made that my career, that I kind of, they saw it as this divot, like I was doing this weird thing for a while, right? I mean, I wasn't doing real software, I was off doing this weird thing. I mean, I was being paid, so they had some respect for it. But, it's hard for me to explain to someone today. Now in the software industry, this is taken for granted, right? People work on this stuff all the time and they get paid because somebody wants it to work or wants it fixed. Mm. But at the time, It was not how you did things, right? And so I have been through this kind of societal shift before, and it took 20 years, right? 1991 was when Linux was first written, and it really wasn't until 2008 that it really started to dominate. We went through the same kind of debates, like, how does this thing become mainstream? What's going to happen? Mm-hmm. We were completely wrong about most of it. Most of it is just time. There were people, old timers, who were like, no, that's not how you write software. We'll never be writing stuff like that. We would never use something like that. They retired, right? And people who had grown up and had always been there and who were just much more naturally comfortable with the idea moved into more senior positions and went, well, of course we're going to use that because it does these things we need, right? Mm. It's been around, it's reliable, it's free, price doesn't hurt. And I see a lot of similarities to that with the Bitcoin journey, right? Mm. In this case, people have this concept of how money is produced. It is created by a government and it has these properties, right? That's just how money is. And a bunch of hippies on the internet can't produce money. That's just like axiomatically clear to everyone. So that takes time to overturn, right? When you've generally got something new and different, you go through all these cycles. And, you know, I was kind of on the bleeding edge of the Linux thing because it was fun and technical, but it really did change the way these things work. And a case in point, if we look at Bitcoin's probably immediate predecessor in a commercial sense, you'd have to look at like DigiCash, Xiaomi and David Xiaomi's company. And they did what you did with software, right? They patented it, they owned it, they ran the servers, it was their software, it was all proprietary and everything else, totally centralized. Because that was how you did it in the 90s, right? That was how the world worked. The whole conversation moved. Satoshi probably never even considered the idea of doing a proprietary Bitcoin, because we now take that for granted and the world has moved. So it will be hard, I think, in a post-Bitcoin world to explain to kids what it was like before Bitcoin, right? Because these things just become acclimatized. You don't say, no, we had to convince people that this was real. Like, well, but isn't it obvious? Like, well, yeah, it is to you now, but it wasn't then. And the other thing is, it's going to take 25 years. These things take a generation. It really does. There are a few people who'll see it and change and move, but unless there's a crisis, most people, you know, it worked yesterday, it will work tomorrow. And there's a huge amount of social momentum. And that probably in some ways is good, but it can be frustrating if you're like, well, but next year, right? There's this joke about the year of the Linux desktop, but it was probably first made in 1998. Because Linux thought that we were going to take on Windows, right? We were going to win. And, you know, so is 1998 the year of the Linux desktop? And it became this running joke for like, it probably still is a running joke, actually. It's 2023, the year of the Linux desktop. You know, we never quite made it. We made it everywhere else, though, right? Android phones, the most common operating system on the planet, is running Linux. And all 500 of the top 500 supercomputers run Linux. But we never got the desktop. And that's part of the problem of trying to predict where these things go, right? You think you know where you're going, and you can be massively successful and never quite get the thing that you, you know. So when people go, is Bitcoin going to kill Visa? I think, no, Visa may end up using Bitcoin, sure. But, you know, it's not a straight line like that. These things are often way weirder than you'd expect. And that's because we too are bound by the past, right? We're trying to extrapolate from what we know. Mm. And when something fundamentally changes, stuff just gets weird. Mm. And you can make a few predictions, but I guarantee you will be wrong on some of them.
It's a really great point you're making. I love that. And just something that springs to mind is entrepreneurs 20 years ago, or 20 years plus, were going, every single company you can think of today, providing it survives, is going to have .com after its name.
Yep.
And it's like, it's completely bonkers to think now that, you know, companies that are of any size don't have a digital footprint of some form. Yep. But there was once a time when it's like, oh, actually, this is how it's going to look. And hindsight's just so fantastic like that, isn't it? And that whole phrase of, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So just because we're using historical information doesn't mean that we actually have a clue about what's going to happen in the future. Well, absolutely. Yeah, very powerful. Where do you see things playing out, and how do you explain to people why like Bitcoin is so valuable? So when you've been through this process of working on open source stuff in the past and Bitcoin comes along, I love that angle. So it's like, okay, you've seen a project like Linux take time, get big, is everywhere, but people might not know.
So it's an interesting question. I mean, I still get a lot of pushback from my colleagues because we end up with the crypto noise, right? So there's a lot of...
Very hard to get away from.
Yeah. If I looked at the industry as a whole and all of crypto, I'd be like, yeah, burn it to the ground. I completely understand, right? Because there is just so much crap. I do feel like Satoshi had this really coherent vision for how things were going to go. And he goes, okay, so we need to solve the double spend problem. This will allow us to switch, you know, in order to do this, we need to create our own currency. And people went, you can create your own currency? And that's the bit that people went, oh, I could create my own currency. And they all tried it, right? And unfortunately, it was successful enough that that became the thing for, God, it's been going on for over a decade now. I'll create my own currency. And the whole altcoin thing, right? Which just fundamentally have a very different motivation from the motivation we saw in 2008, 2009, in the early days of trying to create this long-held vision of this online bearer asset, right? This digital currency, which was such a quest for such a long time, and nobody had quite figured out how to do it. So there's a lot of noise in the ecosystem, and there's, sure enough, the ability to send money around the world is the ability to pick pockets around the world, right? So it's not, in retrospect, hugely surprising, but anywhere there's money, there'll be scammers, right? So you end up with this ecosystem of noise. And so for people coming in, that's a huge repulsing effect, because if they come in the wrong way, right? Mm. If you come in like I did, you're like, okay, I'll read the white paper, I'll go ask some dumb questions and read the mailing list. And you know, I was lucky to come in that angle and it was all straightforward. Oh, this is an open source project. I know how to deal with these. This is fine with the code. And oh, this is kind of cool. But you come in today, like you Google Bitcoin, you will end up someone's SEO trap shitcoin, right? That noise is going to be really, really hard to shake. And I still have friends, my ex-colleagues still think I'm insane, right? They're like, oh, I do not understand what I'm doing. They do not understand Bitcoin. I'm a developer, right? So I don't shill, I don't sell. You will get Bitcoin in your own time. You know, if you're in Australia in your first world country, you probably don't need it, frankly. It's just not at that need stage for you. And that is fine, right? There are people who do need it. And there are definitely things that we can improve, and I'm concentrating on those. But if it's not for you, that's great. So I tend not to push very hard. I think everyone's got this story of, you know, someone comes to them that they know, they're close to, and they go, "How? Oh, so I'm interested in this Bitcoin thing." So you sit them down, you give them the talk, right? You say, it's not a short-term investment, it's incredibly volatile. So you're thinking like, put your money away, put money you're prepared to lose, looking at a 10-year kind of investment horizon, that kind of thing. So it's going to go up and down, you know, so just think of it as put it away, forget, come back in 10 years, see how it's gone. That's the kind of thing. You know, self-custody, here's your hardware wallet. Yes, write down your seed words. I'll walk you through that. Yes, give me a copy and I will store them too. And they immediately lost their seed words. And I only found that out because it was 2 months later and they wanted to sell because they doubled their money, which is great. They doubled their money. I think it went up from like 4,000 or something and they sold quick. And I'm like, okay. I obviously failed in my whole presentation of what this thing was about, right? So there are definitely people who come at it from a pure investment thesis, and I think they miss it too to some extent, right? They're like, well, how do I double my money? Oh, you might be able to double your money, right? It's very volatile. I guess you could. I have absolutely no experience or ability in investments. I am terrible at them. I am still waiting on my money from Mt. Gox because the price went up and I'd bought some play money, Bitcoin early on. I was like, okay, it's kind of a cool technical project. I'll get some Bitcoin to play with. I was recently married. My wife went, half of those are mine because now they were like worth real money. I was like, I had like 10 Bitcoin or something, right? Like $2,000. Yeah. So I sent them to Mt. Gox, the biggest exchange in the world, to get $2,000. Come on, that was like, that's pretty nice. Good, right? Yeah. So I'm still waiting for my to come back through the bankruptcy proceedings. So, you know, I'm terrible at investment advice. And so I generally don't give it. I think there is definitely a strong case that Bitcoin is a weird and different asset class that you should definitely be looking at as far as like a balance portfolio. You know, you probably have some exposure to it. But on the other hand, you know, we are still very early. So the question of like your random person who's not technical going, well, how do I custody this and things like that? But I remember when the Trezor first came out, the first hardware wallet, like it was basically a Kickstarter. I gave one Bitcoin to get my Trezor. It finally broke, actually. But, you know, I think I still have it. I have the pieces somewhere anyway. And, you know, basically the hardware wallet industry had to be created. Bitcoin, right? So we've had to do an awful lot of infrastructure work to get to the point where people even reasonably can hold their Bitcoin, right? And there's more of that to come. Some of it's technical improvements. Some of it's UX improvements. Some of it's just simply best practices and spreading knowledge and stuff like that. And this stuff just takes time, right? To get it good, get it reliable, get it usable. This is going to be a long road. And so I think, yeah, if people take a while to get it, then that's okay. I don't think there's going to be a third project in my life that takes over the world, right? I think I've been pretty lucky to have two technical projects that have, you know, fit my skill set that have really, really excited me.
I mean, if you don't have that, then it's palpable from day to day. If you don't feel excited, you can kind of tell and you get frustrated and you get bored and look for other things. But I mean, just a couple of comments to your points. As an investor, something that I love about talking to someone such as yourself is your technical background. And no, I don't need to understand necessarily everything, even in the white paper, but I need to know that someone who understands what that says is very excited about what this is, has done the due diligence on it themselves, and is confident that it's actually something of value. And I think that's the really most important thing for me from these kind of conversations that I take away. Rusty spent 25 years doing this shit. He's like, this stuff's, you know, this is for real. And that, in my mind, is enough to buy some, basically. It's like, okay, cool. That's enough to allocate some risk in this direction. And I know that I'm not going crazy. But you're right. It all takes time. And the Lindy effect springs to mind. You know, I think it's something like 20 years or so that something has to be around for before people kind of go, oh, that's definitely not going to disappear, which is not really that far off for Bitcoin. We're kind of there now.
Absolutely. And when you think about something as fundamental as money, that makes sense, right? Do you really want to trust a money that's like 5 years old?
Probably not. Why would I take this money off you, mate? It's a load of crap. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just as a very first litmus test, has it been around 25 years? Has it been in existence a generation, right? Mm. Because if you can't assess anything else, you can assess longevity. And people use that as a proxy, for better or worse, of reliability. So, you know, there's not a magic number we hit, but I think over time you go, oh yeah. But it's like everyone's Bitcoin story. I don't know anyone who the first time they heard about Bitcoin dived down the rabbit hole and went, yeah, great.
It doesn't exist.
Oh, this weird Bitcoin thing. You know, you've got to be slapped on the head a few times before it kind of sinks in.
Yeah.
So, you know, magnify that by everyone. And yeah, it'll be a gradual and slow process. It is exciting.
How pumped are you about what you're seeing and what you're working on? And I mean, it's obviously something that, you know, gets you out of bed every day. Just,
yeah, literally
that word excitement, like, teach us about why you're excited.
We did this prototype implementation of the Lightning Network, and then, you know, Lightning Labs was formed. And so, and Async in France also pivoted to go, cool, we're going to implement Lightning as well because we think it's cool. Everyone's just like, this is cool, we've got to implement it, right? So the three of us met together in Milan. I think it was Scaling Bitcoin Milan 7 years ago, 6 years ago, I think. Wow. And we thrashed out basically what was going to be in the first version because we all wanted to interoperate, right? And so then I chaired the spec meetings. And the spec meetings at 5:30 a.m. Adelaide time. And every second Tuesday, right? And I get up for them. I am not a morning person, right? But, you know, to me, the fact that I've done that for almost 7 years indicates a kind of conviction and attachment to this project.
And that is a bit of proof of work if you need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we're tolling away trying to make this payment network when the Bitcoin narrative shifted away from payments into like store of value. And everyone's like, store of value. Like, well, they don't even use it for payments. And we're like, wait, we're still working. But we kept going, right? We just kept working on it, kept the improvements, tweaking it, you know, improving implementations and everything else. And it felt pretty ungratifying there. Like 4 years ago, we're like, oh, yeah, we kind of got something. And I was like, we know Bitcoin doesn't scale. I was like, yeah, we know. That's why we're working on this. But yeah, we know Bitcoin doesn't scale. It's going to be store of value, right? It's all spill store of value story kind of went. And I'm like, I think we can have both. And at the time, that was very much a no, that's a big blocker argument, right? So yeah, it is kind of gratifying to see it in the wild, right? El Salvador, this is actually kind of cool to see your technology actually used. You know, I was the author of Bolt 11, for example. So all the invoices that you see, like that was me. I'm like, oh, cool, that's kind of nice. So yeah, that is pretty exciting. But there's so much more ahead, right? There's so much more that we can do with the technology. And I think we're building this platform on which people build businesses and ideas and everything else. And that takes a while, because there are businesses that don't exist because there was no way of doing the thing that they might have wanted to do. And by definition, they're invisible. We have never had a good scheme for micropayments. We've never had a good way to charge someone 1 cent. And as a result, we have a whole new business models involving eyeballs and ads and everything else. We have some business models involving trying to amortize payments because there's no point charging less than like 10 bucks to a credit card. So you're trying to like group them together. And I am certain that there are a class of businesses that simply never existed because there was no way for them to sustainably do so. There was no way to charge 100 people 1 cent or 100 people 10 cents or something. And so when something doesn't exist at all, you end up with this hole that you can't see in the industry. You just occasionally get glimpses of it because a business try to accept credit cards and they can't do it because of the reversal risk. Certain industries, that's a huge problem for them. But that's because they're dealing in credit. And the reason they're dealing in credit is there's no way to send 10 cents over the internet. So, you know, you see gaps in the existing solutions and it avoids a whole heap of potential ideas. Now, the problem is you've got the new idea, cool, we can do micropayments on the internet. And those entrepreneurs had this idea, but it never worked because they couldn't do it. Need to find the other idea, right? And add two and two together and produce something. And I will probably say that this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, right? And I'll be wrong. You know, it'll be something like, really? No one's going to do that, right? And it'll be, go viral. It'll be insane. It'll be some wild thing because one, I have no business sense. And two, because it probably will look like something because it will not have existed before. So, you know, it's really hard to tell where the ship is going.
Rusty, let me jump in and give you a very real example because it'll help steer this in terms of the ship slightly. So I recently did a year in review having done the podcast for 12 months and I have been paid $45 Aussie on Fountain in value for value boosts and streams. Yep. And interestingly, that $45 is from 422 participants, wow, which I've just calculated on my phone is 10 cents per participant.
There you go.
And so you think, wow, okay. So that's micropayments for a content producer via an app, Fountain, yep, so an application layer on top of Bitcoin using Lightning. Yep. And it does make your mind just fly, doesn't it, to think, okay, well, what business models haven't feasibly been able to exist because you didn't have a native digital currency to send 1 cent? And yep, that is actually, I've never asked that question, Rusty. What a brilliant point to bring up. So what are some of the things that you have come across that you know are already kind of using this opportunity? So Fountain, value for value content creation is one. Are there other areas that you've come across that are using your technology like that?
Yeah, there was an interesting reach out from a telecommunications provider. They're a backhaul telecommunications provider. And there are a whole heap of basically, if you're a small telephone company, and there's apparently a huge number of worldwide small, yep, telephone companies who basically want to buy backhaul. They want to buy the right to route calls through one of these major networks, right? And they're like, we can't do it. Because there are two kinds of customers. There are the customers who are big enough that we get the lawyers together, we sign contracts, we have escrow, we do all those things for payments. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who want to pay by credit card. We're not fucking taking credit card because too many scammers, too many reversals, too many things, right? We can't make money because, you know, they might do $100 worth, right? And it's just not
worth it.
You know, there's a huge, and they're like, we know we do not have any of these customers down here, right? At the bottom of that. And there's a significant number of them because we cannot take the credit card risk, right? We will get screwed. And they were, huh, if we had a bearer instrument. Now, those talks, in fact, didn't go anywhere because, you know, a large corporation and, you know, the person who was interested in the Bitcoin thing, I was a bit too weird for them. But then we get Bitcoin, right? And so those are the kind of conversations that bubble over, right? You know, somebody at one point will go, oh, there was that idea. You know, someone will come again and bang their head against the same problem again and go, oh, but this time Bitcoin's maybe a bit more acceptable, a bit more accepted. The technology's a bit more mature. It's a bit more like they can buy it off the shelf and they come back around. And so there was definitely a business need there. There still is. They still don't have a decent solution. So there's just a huge underserved market, right? And we know that exists.
And so it really is just time, isn't it? That will eventually kind of click into place, won't it?
It's part of that time thing, right? And to some extent, so all kind of progress is kind of a statistical effect of, you know, there are a certain number of people who can make progress. You know, they're in a position to make a change and do something. Hey, we could start doing this, right? And then it will become a win and snowball. They have to know about the technology and then they have to be able to implement the technology, right? And these things have to all come together at once. So you can have someone who's got a great idea, but they don't have the ability to implement it, or they can't find someone to implement it for them. So you need the implementations to be mature enough that they can pretty much off the shelf, they can download the software, or I'll, you know, click on this and I'll pay $300 a month or whatever it is. And hey, it works, right? So there's got to be that. They've got to find that. Right, in a busy world full of all kinds of stuff, they've got to find the thing that does the thing they need, and then they've got to be in a position to actually utilize it. Mm. And far too often, there are not enough people in the world, right? Mm. You end up with the overlap of people who've bought of those three things is zero. And so stuff just doesn't happen. And afterwards it happens, you go, why didn't that happen earlier? It's like, well, because it's a statistical effect where you can go for a long time without these magic things coming together, even though in retrospect, it's kind of obvious. And this is the problem, right? We're inside the Bitcoin space. We're looking at this stuff. It's obvious to us, but we're still very small. And to the outside world, there are a whole heap of people out there who I'm sure have great ideas who just haven't heard yet that we can do this stuff. So yeah, I'm not even going to posit a guess at what it could be, but I just know there's a hole that someone's going to fill and they're going to do really well.
I couldn't agree more. And it's that whole process that information doesn't flow through markets fairly. And so you don't ever see the same stuff at the same time as everyone else. And I mean, much like in some ways, the Cantillon effect, you know, functions from the fiat money printer, like people get it first before others do and prices move in favor of those that get it first, et cetera, et cetera. And we know how that story plays out.
But Rusty, actually, as part of your investment thesis, actually. So the other thing that is unique to Lightning is the symmetry. And this is weird. So in the credit card world, overheads, you can do a single cents, right? That's kind of interesting. The other thing that's interesting is it's not credit. That was what I was alluding to. You actually got their money. You've really got their money. When they pay, you've got it. And that makes potentially makes some things different. The third thing is it's symmetrical. So with credit cards, you know, almost everyone can use a credit card or a debit card, right? They're handed out like candy. But, you know, most of us can't accept credit card. I mean, there's, you know, there are hacks to try to do it, but basically I get your Stripe account and get your credit card reader and get all those things, right? So it's not symmetrical, right? So Lightning Network is symmetrical. In fact, it works best when it's symmetrical. Peer-to-peer cash, like really this ability that everyone who sends can receive is the technology itself is neutral in a way credit cards are not. Now, a lot of people are building layers on top that look very much like the systems they have, which is fine, completely understandable. But it's possible that something comes together that is more about, we think about how are people going to buy stuff with Lightning. But maybe in a symmetrical world, we're speaking as much about how are people going to sell stuff with Lightning, right? So, you know, the fact that it's symmetrical potentially opens new opportunities at scale for vendors, as well as, you know, so it's rather 400 people sending you money, sending you 10 cents each, right? It could be you sending 400 people 10 cents each, right? Because that hasn't really worked before. So now, I don't know what that means, but it is one of the other three differences between the system that we're used to now and what's coming out with Lightning.
What an interesting explanation. It's kind of like when you do an ideation process, you know, I want something and you get a list of answers and you say, I don't want something. And you actually often get a completely different set of answers. And to your whole point about market size and market opportunity, it's never existed before. So what's going to come out of it? We don't know. Okay, Russ, so what I'm intrigued by then is the relationship between an open source software that is not proprietary and therefore doesn't generate value to pay developers to work on it, and the need to generate an income as a developer, you know, to live your life, et cetera. So how does that balance out on the day-to-day?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I keep wondering why they keep dumping money on my lawn to do something that I would do as a hobby anyway. Yeah, there's a certain amount of that. I'm a pretty good computer programmer. You know, I've been doing this for years. I'm pretty experienced, fairly well-respected, I think. At least ChatGPT told me I was well-respected because they asked, who is Rusty Russell? I told me. Did nice things about me, but it is very polite. So I keep getting paid to fix problems for people, right? People are like, we want this to work well, Rusty. Or we want you to write this system, Rusty. And the fact that it's going to be available to everyone, not just them, is table stakes. But they don't care because they have utility value. They're like, no, we need this to exist.
Okay.
And this is the shift, right? I don't have this conversation anymore. Like, well, but you realize that it will also be available to everyone else. That's now assumed. And that is a humongous cultural shift over the last 25 years.
Interesting.
That didn't exist before.
Wow.
Having that conversation 25 years ago, people would have assumed that they're going to own all the software and they're going to have it completely proprietary, whereas people now assume the other way. The world has shifted and people want the work done, right? They want it fixed, right? They don't care who owns the software, which is actually a very healthy kind of, you know, we just want this to work, right? We need this thing to connect this thing to this other thing. And I'm like, great, I can make that for you. And they don't really care if other people also get the benefit of that. So that actually has generally worked pretty well. That doesn't mean that everything that I work on is always released instantly. There's some stuff that is either obscure or, of course, there is some weird backend stuff that is, you know, simply not useful to anyone else. But generally, I mean, that's the stuff that drives me as well, because the vast majority of people will never use the source code. They'll never get out there and play with it and everything else. But every so often, you get this contribution from someone going, hey, I was reading through this, and did you notice this? And I'm like, I want to hire you, right? You know, I mean, you know, just procrastinating students are one of like the universal forces, I think, on this kind of stuff. And frankly, a world where an enthusiastic student can pick up my code and learn something from it, or God forbid, freely fix something for me, is, you know, they reach halfway around the world and they send me an email and they go, hey, Rusty, this seems wrong. Like, can we fix it? I'm like, yeah, thank you. Free, you know, like, it's, it really is, you know, and just from a professional fulfillment point of view, the fact that the fewer barriers there are to people being better than me, that's gold, right? Because I love working with people who really stretch me, right? Particularly like in the Lightning space, I'm probably one of the older, just age-wise, but you know, geez, kids these days, right? They keep me on my toes, I'll tell you that. And that's exciting. It gets me up in the morning, right, to work with these. So definitely from a professional motivation, that is really solid. There's been debates over the last certainly 20 years. Are they going to get paid suitably? You know, who's going to fund this? And there's always a worry about this idea of free riding, right? someone will pay for it and everyone else will be free riding. That perhaps is true sometimes. And it, certainly there are cases where you could say, hold on, this isn't fair. Like everyone's using this guy's work, but no one's actually footing the bill when they're, you know, they're on 2 minute noodles. Although it is heard of, it is actually fairly uncommon. There tends to be somebody who's running a real business who needs it badly enough to step up and maintain it. And there's also a certain cultural expectation. The same way a lot of lawyers will do pro bono work, right? Mm-hmm. And it's seen as an expectation. Very much in the software industry, if you want to hire good software developers, they're going to be, the top software developers are going to have those side gigs at the very least. And if something is really critical, then you will expect your developers to be right in there helping maintain that for everyone else. Mm-hmm. Because you need that knowledge and you need it to work. And in practice, this has actually generally worked out really well. And as I said, you know, you can definitely make exceptions. But the proprietary software world is equally full of like disasters. I mean, look at game development, because it would be the classic proprietary software hellhole. So, you know, pick your poison. For me anyway, it certainly worked out really fun. And I, you know, I'm still enjoying it. So
that's awesome insights. Thank you. The first time I really understood the importance of Bitcoin was helped by a graphic that I came across that many people have seen now. Croesus, I'm sure you've come across his writing, has a diagram that shows you how TCP/IP was the base layer for applications like Amazon, Netflix, Google, that are all digital monopolies. And I've been through the startup space that's very much focused on that kind of rebuild us Google, please. And you've got VCs that want to throw money at these kind of big breakout ideas. And Bitcoin and the Lightning Network kind of completely flips that on its head. I think that's what you were explaining in terms of people are happy to pay you to work on Lightning because their third-party application layer on top that does generate some kind of revenues doesn't exist without Lightning functioning correctly.
Absolutely. And in the Lightning space, it's very clear, right? So a lot of Lightning development comes out of places that are looking to use Lightning to do stuff. And we're at that stage where it's not something you can take for granted, right? We're still making improvements, you know, and frankly, if you're driving those improvements, you're going to get your improvements ahead of the queue of the other improvements that we've got on the list, right? It's pretty straightforward. There's a long list of things to do. If you're paying my salary, right, cool, I will push that along. That's well understood. I might say conflict of interest. So we have this rule with implementation. So with the spec process, say it's a new spec idea. Hey, we want to make this change or make this addition. There has to be two independent implementations. And this is an old rule from the internet process. In fact, you mentioned TCP/IP. The RFC process through IETF is you basically write, hey, we should do it this way. And then two people have to go away and implement it independently. And they have to check that they work together, right? They actually interoperate. They do it the same way. You learn, it's not just a token tick box either. You learn a lot of stuff. I write down here, it should do this, 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 and someone else goes away and reads it and does, oh, I thought it meant this. And you're like, well, that's because you wrote it badly or a common misunderstanding. Or it just turned out you didn't write enough. And when you tried to interoperate, it didn't actually work, right? Mm. When they read it, they go, why do it this way? We could just do this. It's way simpler. And you're like, oh, yeah, you're right. You really do that. That meeting of minds and that having an there's nothing quite as, nothing makes an expert like actually trying to do something yourself. That process is really, really important. So in this case, we've got these days four major players in the Lightning space. We've got the LDK, the Lightning Development Kit, written in Rust, led by Matt Corello and that team working on that. We've got Eclair's Phoenix, and they can do sort of Eclair backend from Async. We've got LND from Lightning Labs, and we've got Core Lightning from Blockstream. And there's horse trading involved. Like, we want a new feature in. You've got to find another implementation that also is prepared to implement it and go through the whole process with you. And sometimes, like, okay, well, I'll implement this if you implement that. Right? So that you get a pairwise implementation and you actually really check it out, and then you can push the things forward. Because until it's in the spec and final, you can't really deploy it on the network and get it out there. We already have these kind of issues. So, you know, a new player comes along and they're really interested in some new feature that they want for their product. That's the process. They roll up their sleeves and then we go, cool. Well, if you implement that, I'll implement that. And we push the whole project forward. And at this stage, it's still very much in the hands of engineers. So everyone wants this thing to win, right? To succeed, they want to do it the best. We might disagree sometimes about the shortest path, right? Hey, this one's more important than this one. Oh no, this one's really critical. Yeah, that one can wait. Those kind of things. But at the end of the day, we're all trying to push in the same direction. And that's been incredibly healthy.
And so you're talking me through that situation I hadn't necessarily understood before, but there is a bit of kind of horse trading basically going on in terms of like, this should be done first, this shouldn't be done first, whatever that may be. What's cool to consider though is that everyone shares in the upside of whatever it is that gets generated. And that's just a complete paradigm shift. And I'm sure someone said to me once, and you can tell me if this is wrong, so Bitcoin is the most heavily vetted software in the history of mankind. And that's because of the amount of people that have been able to look at this open source project and try and check it. And it goes back to your comments earlier about student checking your work somewhere. Is that the case?
Is it the most heavily checked? I mean, it is definitely, there is a huge financial incentive. You could find a big hole in Bitcoin, right? I mean, there is definitely money to be made there, right? So you're going to whack that pinata if you can. There are parts of Bitcoin which are incredibly well written, like really strictly written. More strict than any project I have worked on before. LibSecP256K1, which is a very complicated way of saying the cryptography library at the core of Bitcoin today, is an incredibly robust and vetted piece of software, like right down to the incredible details. And it is really solid, and it is a rarefied class of software that I would, you know, that I would trust with. Maybe not my life, but certainly my life savings kind of, you know, everyone's counting on that. That's really important. You know, and then there's a whole ecosystem of software out there. And as you go further out, it gets a bit more, hey, you know, fast and loose. But certainly Bitcoin Core and changes to Bitcoin Core, extremely well reviewed. And the fact that it's open, I mean, you could look at someone like the NASA software, which is incredibly line by line, you know, validated and everything else. But if you're looking at number of eyeballs that see that, Bitcoin would definitely come out ahead on that front, right? Because there's a lot of people looking at it. The Bitcoin software itself grows fairly slowly, and certainly the number of developers looking at it hopefully increases a little bit faster. On the other hand, it's intense work, and I'm not sure how many Bitcoin developers we're doing after 25 years. You look at the Linux world, a lot of the developers are now like in their 50s, right? And they've gone through their 20s, like they were the young college students and they've gone through. But in some ways, it's a lot less pressure than working on Bitcoin, because Bitcoin has this whole political angle. You know, you get lawsuits from crazies, you get all kinds of things that doesn't happen quite so much. Not completely doesn't happen, but doesn't happen quite as much in other projects. So I'm a bit concerned, but we definitely have this idea that we've got to have as many developers as possible looking at it. It's something that goes back at least 10 years. And a lot of development grant organizations, Summer of Bitcoin, Chaincode Labs, there are a whole heap of places that explicitly make this their mission to get more developers doing cool stuff with Bitcoin. And more developers involved. Because, you know, you could imagine this counter scenario where there are only 5 people in the world who understand how Bitcoin actually works under the covers. Well, that's not decentralized either, right? You know, we don't expect everyone to. I mean, obviously, there are certain like hurdles you've got to overcome, but you have to be a developer for a start, right? But certainly making it as approachable and easy as possible is an explicit aim of all the Bitcoin developers that I know. And it's working really well.
Another one of the layers of the onion that one kind of peels back as their research kind of continues down the line. Now, Rusty, what I do is I always fire out a tweet to see if anyone has any questions for who I'm speaking to on the podcast. And I'm going to choose one here, Decent Money 2009. Shout out to them wherever they are. They had a pretty simple question, which was, if you weren't working on Bitcoin / Lightning, what work would you do instead?
Okay, so there's several answers to this. One is, if I wasn't working on Lightning, I'd work on Bitcoin Core. The second one is that, okay, so if I eliminate that one, then I have a side project which has been sort of sitting on the back burner called Century Metadata. It has a website and a spec. And the idea for Century Metadata is that one thing I love about the simple Bitcoin wallets is the 12 words, right? So this seed phrase, 12, 24 words. If you keep that safe, your funds are good. You can lose everything. You can, you know, a truck can run over your hardware wallet, your house burns down, everything else. But if you've got your 12 words, you've got your Bitcoin, right? That is incredibly powerful, right? Unfortunately, it's also becoming less true, because if you have a multi-sig or something in there, you need some more information, right? It turns out you just 12 words isn't enough. You also say, oh, but they're also signed by this, and you can't even find that you have funds. There's all these problems, right? So I was like, I want a service that will store a little bit of data for a century, right? So my wallet can just attach a little bit of data, like, you know, just 64K, like just a small amount that I'll pay up front once, right? I'll pay a handful of sats, go, cool, you will make this data available to me for a century. You know, if you care, if you count per byte, like you can get gigabytes out of Google and stuff like that, but they keep shutting things down. I want something that is actually organized, redundant, set up with trusts in multiple countries, everything you can do to try to guarantee that I can fetch my data back again in a century. When my kids unpack whatever, and they restore from their 12 words, their wallet would reach out to the thing and go, I wonder if there's anything, any metadata attached to these 12 words. Oh, there is. Wow. Okay. So grabs that, decrypts it, and gets the stuff that I've left behind. So I really like this idea. It's technically not very hard. There's a little bit of crypto in there. There's an API to query stuff and an API design so that the server can't tell what you're fetching. So there's a little bit of technical stuff, but mainly setting the stuff up is basically a matter of having it there, having it running for 10 years so that, you know, you've got some track record. And then there are some really cool things you can do, but it's worth putting some money in to set this foundation up and basically have it run with a fairly serious, convincing argument that it will still be there for at least a generation or two. So that's the idea of century metadata, and that is probably what I would be hacking on, because I think it's another hole in the Bitcoin ecosystem that I love this idea that my 12 words will get me everything back. One of the cool things that's happening at the moment is this zero knowledge proof and this Fedimint idea. And this is perfect for this. I would issue these Fedimint tokens, and a token would give you the ability to store data for 100 years. So then I could print, I don't know, 100,000 of these, and you get them with your hardware wallet, right? So you grab a Ledger or Trezor, whatever, whoever's, you know, signs a deal. And I don't know, and nobody knows which ledger it is attached to which thing, but you automatically get this tiny bit of storage that you can use. And then when you restore your wallet, it reaches out and goes, is there any storage associated with this? Yes, there is, and pulls it back, right? So this persistent storage of a little bit of data gets you over that hump. You can just fit a surprising amount in a little bit of data. You can just fit your last will and testament. You can fit, you know, instructions to peers. You can fit a whole heap of like, hey, there's also this other keys out here, this cold storage, other stuff to be done, but all derived from that same 12 words. So that is the answer to what I would be hacking on if I weren't hacking on this.
Have you come across Mike Dunworth's work?
No.
So Mike's been on my podcast. Great guy. Shout out to Mike wherever he is. And he's working on some really cool stuff about basically sending sats into the future and what that means for the recipient of said sats in the future. And I won't butcher it because it's well worth having a read properly. But anyone out there that hasn't had a look, have a look. And Rossi, check out some of the work he's done. He'll be at Bitcoin Alive, so you'll get a chance to have a chat with him there.
Fantastic.
But it's this idea of working on projects with longevity of 100 years that actually have a good chance of being valid. Like, you know, yes, an architect in years gone by is like, I want to build this incredible building and I want it to last forever. And they've done a pretty bloody good job of lasting 100 years, some buildings in some case. But information for that duration of time, I don't know whether that's ever been possible before. Like, yes, a written book, I guess you could do. But, you know, an 80-year lifespan is not long enough to keep information for 100 years. So you can't have one human, you need two. What if they pass it on wrong and to the wrong person? Or all these different questions are coming to my mind. So it's, wow, what a really fascinating thing to be thinking about. How much time do you have to even look into that and hack away?
That is a really good question. I keep thinking I should take a holiday and do that, but there's too much else going on. There always is, right? So,
you know, 5:30 on a Wednesday rather than Tuesday, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, you know, I also manage the team at Blockstream and doing all that. So It's, you know, there are always more things to do. And hopefully I've got a lot of time ahead of me to do it. So the idea won't die. It'll come along at some point. But you do have to cherry pick, which is all the exciting projects. The thing is that Bitcoin, and we've discussed a few of these things with Lightning, there's all this green fields out there, right? Mm. And when you're standing on the edge of this, because you're in this ecosystem where you have that, the future's already here, it's just not evenly distributed kind of feeling.
Yep.
You can see all these opportunities, and trying to pick which one or which ones, like a handful that you could possibly do, is really part of the challenge. You could, I think you can easily get kind of deadlocked, shell-shocked, trying to just, there's so many things I could do, right? Yep. Sometimes you just got to pick one and you got to go. And Lightning is my one. Awesome. Lightning is the thing I think that I can do the most value with, driving like the spec process, making sure we get things right. Yeah, we'll have to revise things, but at least getting as close as possible and driving that forward has been, you know, incredibly rewarding and something I think, having had that experience, this is kind of my job. You see something that he's doing, you do it, right? So,
Rusty, I can feel your excitement. It's who knows what's going to happen, but there is so much to do. Actually, just to resonate for a moment, came back from the Bush Bash in Beechworth this weekend. It was a huge amount of fun. It's my second time going to the event. And it's amazing when you see all these people that have got together in a room and are talking shop. You know, I've got this idea, I'm doing this, I've done this piece of work. Just amazing, the collaboration that comes out of it, the new friendships, the ones you've, you know, improved on from the previous year. And everyone's really pumped. And I don't think in my life I've ever been involved in a space quite like that, which is very cool. Well, Rusty, listen, so thank you so much. That was really awesome to spend some time together. Final question is, where can people reach out and get in touch if they want to do so?
So I am still waiting for the Nostra plugin for Ride the Lightning app, which they promised me they were working on at some point. So until then, you have to catch me on Twitter, which is rusty_twit on Twitter. I also have my shit Bitcoin essay account, which is basically mocking people. Not so much fun in bear markets. It's usually good in bull markets when people are doing, you know, wild and outrageous claims about how we're going to the moon tomorrow. And then I get to mock them mercilessly. But yeah, a lot of stuff comes out of Blockstream with my name on it as well. So you can follow me around there, but that's probably the best way of doing it.
Awesome. Thanks so much for your time, Rusty. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jake.
Okay, friends. Nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best. Jake.